From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about President Trump's right-hand troll. It's the title of a recent Atlantic article written by the journalist McKay Coppins, a profile of the 32-year-old White House speechwriter and senior policy advisor Stephen Miller. Coppins says Miller's rise to power raises the question of what happens when a right-wing troll grows up to rule the world. We'll be right back.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist McKay Coppins has recently written a profile of Stephen Miller for The Atlantic magazine. Miller is the 32-year-old speechwriter and senior policy advisor for President Trump. He helped draft and then sell the president's controversial travel ban. By his political opponents, Miller is known for his public spectacles, where he provokes liberals, challenges what he calls cosmopolitan bias, and he can come across as smug and insufferable. But his allies see him as charming, as a brilliant strategist. Coppins says Miller's political worldview is rooted in what he calls a deep-seated instinct for trolling, which he cultivated really early in his life. It's a technique that has come to dominate campus conservatism in the country today. Guys like Miller aren't your typical college Republican types, you know, button-down conformists. They're rabble-rousers. They use provocation to goad progressives into becoming outraged. In fact, Coppins writes, liberal tears are the coin of the realm in this world. McKay Coppins is joining us today to talk about his article. It's titled, Trump's Right-Hand Troll. He joined us from the studios of The Atlantic magazine in Washington, D.C.
Trump has tended to populate his inner orbit with kind of outsized personalities and characters who are often on TV or kind of in the news or being parodied on SNL. And that really has not been Stephen Miller's role. He's, you know, just 32 years old, so he's relatively young for the kind of position he has. He joined the Trump campaign pretty early on as a speechwriter. And when Trump won, he became a senior advisor on policy to the president. And he has conducted most of his business kind of under the radar, behind the scenes. And that, I think, actually has been the key to his longevity in this White House, whereas a lot of other people in the first, you know, year and a half of the Trump presidency have kind of flamed out in dramatic fashion. Miller has continued to have the ear of the president on several issues, especially immigration. He is able to kind of show the kind of deference and loyalty to Trump that is necessary to maintain your perch in the pecking order in this White House. And because of it, he's becoming remarkably influential and powerful.
It's a terrible idea to upstage any boss, but particularly this boss. And it seems like that's something that he gets.
That's right. It's funny. When I approached them about doing this profile, I knew that that was actually going to be one of the hurdles because everyone in this White House is worried about, you know, upstaging President Trump. Yeah. And I actually think I detected a little bit of relief when they found out that this would not be a cover story, that Stephen Miller's face wouldn't be on the cover of The Atlantic. That might be the death blow
right.
for him.
You say right up front in the piece that it's not easy trying to figure out whether Miller is trolling you. And I mean this honestly, isn't he always trolling you or someone like you who writes for a magazine I'm sure he disdains, sees it as kind of a tool, you know, of the liberal elite? I mean, that seems like that's part of his persona, is trolling people like you. Do you know what I mean?
There's no question. Yeah. I mean, I knew that going into the conversation, right? I mean, everyone who's ever known Stephen Miller since he was, you know, a teenager will tell you that you can never quite tell you know, what kind of bit he's doing at any given moment. You know, he always seems to be kind of trying to get a rise out of you, provoke you, elicit some sort of reaction. I mean, when I was in his office kind of talking to him, this manifested itself sometimes in kind of little ways. Like at one point, he kind of made this extremely emphatic case that The Dark Knight Rises, the Batman movie, was the best movie he'd seen in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
And when I kind of raised an eyebrow at that, he, you know, was chiding me for not properly appreciating the movie's commentary on the French Revolution. And finally, he said something like, you know, I thought you would understand that. You'd be all over that. And I kind of was like, well, you know, why? Me specifically?
Yeah.
And then he sarcastically kind of smiled and said, well, it's just your reputation as a very deep thinker. Which was like just one little micro example of how Stephen Miller's just constantly kind of trying to agitate or kind of needle you.
What's he like? He isn't exactly charming or doesn't come across that way. In fact, you say in the piece that there is some kind of charm-like substance that he does possess, though.
Right. Well, it's weird because in public, if you have seen him on TV and if you've been aware of him, he's always kind of sporting this what I call a perma glower, where
totally.
He's, you know, very intense and very kind of almost angry and, you know, defending the president in this very kind of abrasive way. In person, he's not exactly like that. You can see a lot of that, but he's also kind of. I you know, I have to say he can be funny.
Yeah.
Not charismatic because I don't think anybody comes away from a conversation saying, wow, I really liked that guy.
Yeah.
But there's something, you know, that draws you in about his whole shtick. He can be very smart. He can also, you know, the needling you is kind of interesting. I often found myself kind of jousting with him. and I guess the whole thing. It doesn't make you like him, but it makes you kind of interested in trying to figure him out, right?
Yeah,
that's something that I've heard from a lot of people who've known him.
There's this question that I have to say I kept asking myself throughout the piece, and it seems like it's something that you are wondering about too, and that is this guy serious? And what I mean by that is, like, is he serious about his conservative beliefs? I mean, he's clearly conservative. I don't mean that. I mean ideologically. But is he committed to those ideas, or is he more interested in the kind of the performance art, you know, the provocation about it? And maybe they go hand in hand, but that is something that I kept wondering throughout the piece.
Well, it is kind of the question that powered the whole piece.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important because Stephen Miller is not alone in this persona, right? There's actually a whole generation of conservative activists that are around his age, maybe a little younger, but that are currently, you know, wreaking havoc on college campuses or, you know, picking fights on Twitter or writing for kind of websites like Breitbart, whose whole, like, ethos is defined by trolling and agitation and provocation. And it's often very difficult to parse what when they're talking, whether they're stating genuine beliefs or whether they're saying things just to get a rise out of you, just to outrage you.
Yeah.
And what I found with Stephen Miller is, I'd make two points. One is he does seem to have genuine ideological beliefs. He is a kind of right-wing nationalist. He is a hardline restrictionist on immigration. He is, you know, a law and order conservative in his words. These are real beliefs that he's had for a long time.
Yeah.
But what I realize is that his whole kind of career has been defined by articulating these beliefs in a way that is designed to agitate rather than persuade. He is not interested in winning over converts. He's interested in eliciting the most hysterical, embarrassing reaction from his ideological foes so he can then point to that as proof that he was right, that his side is better or more righteous or more reasonable or whatever.
And it seems like his opponents often take that bait. And we'll get back to that. There's this story you tell about on the campus of Duke, how he would basically, it seemed like he would kind of manipulate people on campus to get into these shouting matches. And it was the thing that he wanted.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in fact, he told me when I would talk to, I talked to him about kind of his youthful activism in high school and college and then going on throughout his career. He actually told me that he, you know, first he said he's not a fan of what he calls provocation for its own sake.
Yeah.
But then he kind of thought about it and I pressed him a little bit more and he admitted that he has always found value in generating what he called constructive controversy with the purpose of enlightenment.
Right.
So, you know, at Duke that manifested itself in organizing what he called an Islamo-fascism awareness week,
yeah.
which was kind of, you know, very incendiary posters and speakers and events organized around, you know, criticizing Islam and radical jihad. He also would bring controversial speakers to campus. He, you know, when the Duke lacrosse scandal became a big dominant episode at Duke, he was, you know, immediately took the contrarian position.
Yeah.
And kind of reveled in the hatred that that it earned him. This is very much part of his kind of persona, and he seems to kind of almost be giddy about it when he when he's able to get liberals around him to take the bait.
Let's back up a bit to when he first takes to all of this, and it turns out it's a school magazine drive. His conservative education begins when he gets a copy of Guns and Ammo. Tell that story. Mm-hmm. It's a good one.
Yeah, so he was in seventh grade, and he what he told me is that he needed one more sale to qualify for the, you know, prize, you know, these middle school magazine drives. And he decided to just buy himself a subscription to Guns and Ammo, not because he had any special interest in guns at the time. I mean, he grew up in Santa Monica in a very liberal household. Guns were not a big part of the culture there, but he thought it was interesting and, you know, it looked better than Time magazine or whatever. So he bought a subscription. And he was flipping through the magazine and he came across a column written by Charlton Heston, who, you know, fun fact, a little piece of trivia, he, you know, famous movie star, but then turned into a gun rights activist later and wrote this column for Guns and Ammo. And he told me that this was the first conservative writing he'd ever read. And so from there, he came to a book by Wayne LaPierre, who'd be the NRA president, called Guns, Crime, and Freedom. Which he told me he devoured. And what he said is that it raised this question for him. Reading that book raised this question. He said, I remember thinking to myself, if what I believe is true is so wrong on these issues, you know, Second Amendment gun issues, what else could I be wrong about?
Yeah.
And that kind of sent him into this, you know, on this path to becoming a full-fledged kind of conservative in a place where there were very few outspoken conservatives.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, I have to say that made me think, well, you know, he's sincere, like he's actually looking for some kind of truth, not just to piss people off, even though there's, you know, both of that in him. But I also have to say the people who influenced his thinking, you know, his, I guess you could put it, intellectual mentors are not terribly impressive. I mean, as you point out in the piece, I mean, if this is not Edmund Burke or Milton Friedman or even Ayn Rand. I mean, they're talk radio people. They're people like Rush Limbaugh and Wayne LaPierre.
I thought that was so – it was one of the most revealing moments for me in our interview where I asked him which books had shaped his kind of political worldview.
Yeah.
And I was expecting, you know, Burke and Friedman and Hayek. And instead what I got was a kind of a procession of like – talk radio personalities like Rush Limbaugh and Larry Elder and David Horowitz and, you know, really people who wrote kind of polemical screeds rather than, you know, political philosophy. And I think that's important because that's not to, you know, the point isn't just that he's a shallow thinker. The point is that he was from a very early age, like early on in his journey, he was drawn not just to the conservative ideas he was encountering, but to the kind of attitude, the style of, you know, 90s right wing talk radio.
Yeah, yeah.
He just found that very viscerally appealing.
McKay Coppins, his article on Stephen Miller is called Trump's Right-Hand Troll. It appears in The Atlantic, where Coppins is a staff writer. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services, whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about President Trump's right-hand troll. That's the title of a recent Atlantic article written by the journalist McKay Coppins. It's a profile of the 32-year-old White House speechwriter and senior policy advisor, Stephen Miller. I was trying to figure out, McKay, how does he get along with his folks these days? I mean, if he's raised in this affluent liberal household, what was parents make of him? Did you talk about that? It's not really in the piece, but I'm interested.
No, I tried to get a hold of his parents. I wasn't able to. Yeah. But by all accounts, actually, he's on good terms with them. In fact, it appears that after Stephen Miller left for college, his parents later changed their voting registration to Republican. Hmm. So they it's possible he converted them, or they kind of followed their son's political journey. He appears to be on good terms because property records indicate that the $1 million condo that Stephen Miller lives in now in D.C. were actually his parents helped pay for.
Yeah.
So, well, haven't cut him off.
Right. They haven't cut him off. And we do have to point out, as you do in the piece, that his ideas were absolutely influenced kind of by his repulsion to the things that he was seeing around him in Santa Monica. I mean, a lot of his ideas were this reaction to Santa Monica, to that kind of liberal bastion.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because Santa Monica, it's not just like any kind of, blue bubble. This is a very almost kind of a self-parody of a, know, rich liberal town. The people there kind of considered themselves, members of this progressive utopia. And they had festivals celebrating multiculturalism. And at this high school, there were racial harmony retreats. And, you go there today and there's, Bernie Sanders bumper stickers on like extremely expensive sports cars. Yeah. And, it's very much it's easy to see how a kind of teenager prone to puckishness, to rebellion, and to maybe a little bit of cynicism, might look around and see a lot of culture that he didn't want to be a part of. And I actually talked to one of his friends at the time, someone he grew up with, who's now a progressive activist named Jason Islas, and he said that he even said that it was the kind of place, Santa Monica, where wealthy white liberals would conspicuously celebrate diversity in a very self-congratulatory way and then not actually put their money where their mouth was, right? Yeah. And Miller seemed to kind of rebel against that, and a lot of his kind of new political persona that he was forming as this kind of right-wing gadfly came out of wanting to needle his kind of self-righteous neighbors.
Do you think that's kind of a theme in this story or this new breed of conservative activists, that in some ways that's a commentary about the excesses or the kind of posing nature of liberalism today, or some strands of liberalism today?
I really do. It's interesting. While I was working on this piece, I came across a really smart essay in the New York Times by a woman named Catherine Manju Ward, who's the editor of Reason magazine. So she's a libertarian. Yeah. But she wrote this piece about, it was called When Smug Liberals Met Conservative Trolls, and sort of kind of laid out this idea that the dominant force on the right today is trolling, right? And a desire to generate outrage in their foes. And the dominant force on the left, or at least elements of the left, is this kind of smugness, right? This sort of self-satisfied self-righteousness. Yeah. And that the two those two forces kind of combine to reinforce this terrible cycle that we have in our discourse, where the more smug liberals are, the more conservatives want to outrage them. And the more, you know, ridiculous and outrageous conservatives are, the more smug liberals become.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think that that is something that I've – that – that powered Stephen Miller, and it also, you know, powers a lot of his peers. Now, that's not to let anyone off the hook, right?
No.
Just because, you know, your neighbors are self-righteous doesn't mean that you have to start saying, you know, wildly offensive things but to get a rise out of them. But it does seem like that was part of the dynamic that helped shape his political worldview.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually want to get back to that point, how in some ways a lot of this kind of frivolous – obnoxious reaction to the excesses of liberals hides actual sinister thinking and beliefs.
Yep.
So we'll get back to that. But I have to say, sounds incredibly obnoxious at high school. And I don't just mean that. Like, set aside the politics. I think a liberal kid up in people's mm-hmm. faces would seem in the same way obnoxious. He was just a conservative kid. The story of, for example, when he jumps into the home stretch of a girl's track race to make some obnoxious point about gender roles.
Male
or something.
Athletic
yeah.
supremacy.
I mean, it just sounds obnoxious, honestly. But he did a lot of this crap in high school.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because I bet that listeners, regardless of what kind of political environment they grew up in, probably knew a kid like this,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah,
it's right. the it's like yeah. the kid in your class who's constantly raising his hand, and when he raises his hand, everyone kind of rolls their eyes mm-hmm. because he's just going to say something as annoying as possible to yeah. try to, like, start a fight.
Yeah.
That was Stephen Miller in yeah. high school, no question. I mean, you mentioned the track race. There are, like, 50 stories like that about him. In the most famous story among his high school peers, he ran for student government on a platform of making janitors pick up the kids' trash for
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Basically, he gave a speech. There's actually a video of it that you can see where he gets up, he's speaking to his classmates, and he says, you know, am I the only one who's sick and tired of being told to clean up my trash when there are janitors here to do it for us? Mm-hmm. And what's funny about that video clip is that he gets booed off the stage. You know, immediately the students start booing him, and he's actually removed from the stage by some teacher, administrator or something. And as he's being removed, you can zoom in and see his face, and he just looks so happy, you know, so satisfied with how the whole thing is going. Like, that is, to me, the essence of Stephen Miller as a teenager, and in a lot of ways, Stephen Miller today.
Yeah. Well, his interactions, for example, with women that you write about in college are interesting. Mm-hmm. And one woman said that he liked getting a rise out of people in a very sociopathic way, which mm-hmm. I have to say leads to a question, a legitimate question on some level. Is he a sociopath?
I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not going to answer that. It's not the first time I've been asked.
Yeah.
But I actually think that you can zoom out a little bit and, you know, you don't have to diagnose it. You don't have to call it, you know, that it's sociopathic, but that, you know, there is this kind of fundamental, almost, nihilism at the mm-hmm. center mm-hmm. of a lot of this.
Yeah.
In the terms of modern Twitter, LOL, nothing matters.
Yeah.
There's kind of this idea that, like, you don't have to have core beliefs. It doesn't matter if you really believe what you're saying. It doesn't matter what tactics you use. Mm. The only thing that matters is getting some kind of reaction,
yeah.
right? Generating
yeah.
a reaction.
Yeah.
And it does seem that Stephen Miller is not alone in this way. There's a whole generation of activists and trolls who feed off of that. And I do think that that Stephen Miller is an emblem of that.
You mentioned Jason Eastless, one of his friends, and there's this moment that seemed kind of disturbing or a little troubling. He says at some point to Jason, I can't be friends with you anymore. And one of the reasons he mentions, you say, is Jason's Latino heritage.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit more about that? Because that seems to reveal something I don't know if more sinister, but something deeper going on in some way.
Right. And this gets at the kind of fundamental disagreement or kind of debate that people who knew Stephen Miller throughout his life have, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, what did he say? Because there's no question that he has said a lot of racist things, right?
Yeah.
And said a lot of sexist things and said a lot of, you know, anti-Muslim things, right? And the kind of question that a lot of people have who have known him is, does he say that stuff just to get a rise out of people because he finds it fun and kind of gets kicks out of it? Or does it reveal his inner racism or inner sexism or whatever? And, you know, Jason Islas told me that he thinks both are true. You know, he thinks that Miller does have some kind of deep-seated dislike of Latino people, but also that he, you know, he wants to get a rise out of people. What he called it was a teenage rebellion against an upper middle class liberal establishment that metastasized.
Right.
So it turned into something worse or deeper. And I do think that that more than anything is emblematic of this kind of movement of conservatives and trolls that, you know, there is a kind of, you hinted at it earlier, that there's this tendency to shroud, you know, bigotry or racism or other kind of toxic ideas in a cloak of irony, right?
Yep.
You know, you can kind of pretend like, oh, I'm just winking at it. I'm just being provocative. I'm just, you know, making jokes. But that in fact, in a lot of cases, those people really do believe those things. And this is just kind of a defense mechanism.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that if any slur or slander can be excused as just kind of, you know, ironic, then it becomes all but impossible. This is how you put it in the piece. It becomes all but impossible to distinguish the genuine extremists from those impersonating them for effect.
Right. And you know, I almost the thing that I think I came to writing this piece is that it almost doesn't matter that much, right?
Yeah.
At some point, it stops mattering whether you really are racist or you're just saying racist things for fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or whether you really, you know, believe these things or whether you just think that they're effective trolls. You know, I think at some point you've gone so far down that road. I'm not talking about people who have, you know, said things in years past that then looking back on them, they become more enlightened and they realize, oh, I probably shouldn't have said that, whatever. I'm talking about people who just have made it their life's mission to, you know, spread racist memes on Twitter and Reddit, right? Or to, you know, say these things in public. At some point, I think your true beliefs, whatever those are buried under so many layers of irony and trolling that they're basically irrelevant.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the defining features of our discourse. And I think that people need to come to terms with that, you know, it just saying outrageous things in the name of quote unquote free speech or whatever else doesn't actually get you off the hook from defending, you know, racism or misogyny or other hateful ideologies.
No, because, I mean, you know, look, it's one thing to say you're engaging in performance art, but this is the real part of the story. I mean, there are real consequences to this kind of rhetoric. You mentioned the Anti-Defamation League talking about how incidence of white supremacist propaganda is up. What is it,
260%?
Yeah, 58%.
Yeah, on college campuses.
On college campuses,
Right. And this is another, again, the kind of the question at the center of this piece was there are the questions about Stephen Miller in particular and what he believes and who he is and what motivates him. But then there's this bigger question of what happens when this current generation of campus conservative trolls grows up and starts, you know, running the world, getting the really important jobs in government, in media, in the corporate world, right? What happens when those people grow up and get real positions of influence? And I think Stephen Miller is an early test case of that, because you could, and he does make the case that his high school trolling and maybe even his campus trolling in college at Duke, you know, isn't something that he should be held accountable for as an adult, right? That everyone crosses lines when they're younger, and it's even healthy to be, you know, rebellious when you're a kid and push boundaries or whatever. But then when you take that same trolling ethos and you don't outgrow it and you then bring it into the White House and you have a big spacious office close to the Oval Office in the West Wing, yeah, and you are affecting policy and writing speeches that the leader of the free world is giving in important forums, at some point that ethos translates to real consequences and effects for real people. And I think that that's what we've seen with Miller in the White House.
Miller says that liberals have become the conformists now. And it's one of the themes in the story that you write. And I think there's something instructive in the part where you explain that for Miller, even when he was younger, like in high school, and is certainly his experience in college, it wasn't just liberalism that he was reacting to, but it was the way that they were reacting. That, as you say, they tattled on him and they didn't want to debate, or they just wanted to shut him up. And it isn't this the essence of a lot of these younger conservative reactors today, mm-hmm, that they're reacting to the idea that liberals are just not tolerant. They're not really committed to the ideas of free speech, and they've become the conformists.
Right. And this is actually an argument you hear a lot in this crowd,
yeah,
right? That, you know, what Miller told to me is you looked at the 1960s and the, yeah, kids rebelling against power were the leftists and the hippies and the anti-Vietnam War crowd. Those were the ones kind of rebelling against the establishment and, pushing free speech boundaries. And they were kind of the activists of the era, whereas the conservatives at that time were, hippie punchers,
yeah,
or were at the very least kind of rolling their eyes at all of that. His argument is that dynamic has flipped now, where, mm-hmm, when he was at Santa Monica High School, he said that his liberal classmates didn't want to engage in a debate with him. They didn't want to, try to debunk the things he was saying or fight with him or whatever. Their immediate instinct was to go to the teachers or go to the administration and try to implement, stronger, more restrictive rules about what can be said in classrooms, mm-hmm, basically deferring to authority to help, protect them from ideas and rhetoric that they don't like. And to people like Miller and to, frankly, a lot of young conservatives, that is, they are kind of relishing the fact that they now see themselves as the nonconformists, as the kind of anti-establishment crusaders, and they take a certain amount of glee in the fact that that the culture, in their view, and at least in the places where they are, is so dominated by liberalism that liberal people are afraid of encountering conservative ideas that might challenge them. This is where the term snowflakes, melting, yeah, snowflakes, yep, comes from. Conservative activists like to talk about how too many liberals have been raised in this on this idea that they're very special snowflakes and that they have to be coddled and protected at all times, and that the conservative instinct is to melt them, aka go in and kind of rip them apart and confront them. Mm-hmm. I will say there's a more reasonable, less kind of confrontational argument here that a lot of people have made, including President Barack Obama. Barack Obama has made this point to a crowd of liberal college students. You can find this video online where he says, a lot of the way that my ideas were shaped by confronting, yeah, people who had opposite ideas, mm-hmm, and that college campuses should be places where there's an open debate of ideas. But there is still a question that has not been resolved about what ideas should be tolerated. Everyone, even these free speech, absolutists on the right, would acknowledge that not every single idea should be given, a platform and a voice and be paid attention to. Obviously somebody arguing for genocide wouldn't be given, hopefully, a speech, a slot at a, sure, campus to make that case. So the question is, where is the Overton window? What is, mm-hmm, the acceptable, acceptable area of speech and debate that we're going to engage in?
Did Stephen Miller early on see the potential for Donald Trump? I'm talking about in those really early days, in the GOP primaries in the 2016 mm-hmm. race. Did he foresee, you know, was he particularly prescient, for example, about, you know, this working class uprising, people who would end up vote, even, you know, working class Democrats who would end up voting for Trump in some of those Rust Belt states that were so crucial? Did he foresee something like that? Did he anticipate that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I don't know how, you know, specifically he anticipated, you know, what the Trump coalition would be. But I think he does deserve some credit for being more prescient than most of Washington. I mean, he at the time that Donald Trump entered the presidential race in the summer of 2015, Stephen Miller was an aide to then Senator Jeff Sessions. And he was kind of making his name on Capitol Hill as, again, kind of a right-wing agitator, particularly hawkish on immigration issues. And he was also friends with a lot of Breitbart reporters. And so, you know, in that world, he was kind of seen as a rising star of what was then termed kind of the populist right.
Yeah.
And to him, he saw Donald Trump's candidacy where everyone else on Capitol Hill and in Washington was kind of scoffing at him as, you know, this is a sideshow or this guy is, you know, just undertaking some kind of stupid publicity stunt. He was immediately drawn to Trump. There's actually, you can see, and it's been reported, an email that he sent to someone on Capitol Hill early on saying, I wish Trump would run for president. So this was even before Trump ran.
Wow.
So, you know, but he saw this kind of brash New York businessman who was talking about all the stuff that Stephen Miller had always cared about. You know, yeah. He's an opponent of political correctness and an enemy of the establishment and a hardliner on immigration. But I think he was also, frankly, drawn to Trump's trollishness.
Yeah.
You know, I think that he admired how Trump was able to use the bully pulpit of being a presidential candidate to, you know, to say provocative things that, you know, immediately dominated headlines.
Yeah.
And I think that was a version of what Miller had always done.
Yeah, you say he loved what he saw as the president's talent for performance and provocation. It was the thing that he loved. But there's this story. I wanted you to talk about it. During the GOP primaries, Trump would read from this song about an Aesop fable, the snake, and it delighted Stephen Miller. And this seems to be illustrative of kind of what he liked about Donald Trump. Tell this part of the story.
Yeah, well, the song is this 1960s soul song, and it just tells the story of a woman who takes a half-dead snake into her home and nurses him back to health, and then the snake bites her.
Yeah.
And as she dies, she asks why he did it, and the moral of the story is in the lyrics where the snake responds, "Oh, shut up, silly woman," said the reptile with a grin. "You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in." And Trump uses this to talk about immigration and refugees, basically comparing the kind of poisonous, deceitful snake to refugees and immigrants. And it is – I mean, I was a reporter covering the Trump campaign. I saw him do this live at a lot of his speeches where he just reads the lyrics to the snake.
Yeah.
And the crowd goes wild. And I was always – every time I was not – I was shocked by it. You know, I think it is objectively one of the most kind of demagogic things that he does, the president. And Stephen Miller, when I talked to him, just loves it. He went on for several minutes to me about how Trump conceived of the idea to read the snake, how effective it was with his crowds. He told me that when Trump goes to an event and starts to read the opening lines of the snake, it's like the first three chords of Freebird at a concert. And you know, most you know, people that see this that aren't Trump supporters are totally appalled by it. But that's what makes Stephen Miller love it. And
yeah.
I think it's also, frankly, what makes Trump love doing it, because every time he does it, there's another, you know, massive wave of outrage. And that's, you know, these guys kind of thrive on that.
I think it's interesting the way Miller you noticed how Miller is gushing about the president. You know, he has these natural gifts as a commentator, he says, and he talks about how the president understands comedy and drama, and he imbues what he's seeing in the president with such you know, sort of deep intellectual kind of capacity. And he talks about his wit and speed. And
yeah.
And then you say you kind of notice something familiar about the way Miller is gushing about this. And I wanted you to what did you notice? Because it's like it's deep. Well, it's really rehearsed the way he's doing
because,
it.
Because, what I realized about halfway through it was that, oh, wait, he's done this before. This is actually like a spiel that he's kind of rehearsed. He had done it famously on CNN in an interview with Jake Tapper,
right,
where he was doing this whole spiel, and Tapper kept asking him questions, and Stephen Miller kept kind of avoiding the questions and going back to the same spiel, and the interview kind of devolved into like this ridiculous back and forth, where finally it ended with Tapper cutting Miller's mic and saying, "I think I've wasted enough of my viewers' time." But it's funny because I even in that case, you know, I called Miller on that. I kind of was like, oh, wait, I've heard you do this.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I talked to him about the Jake Tapper interview. And he immediately said that, I mean, this clip went viral. This was like a bit one of Miller's biggest public moments because he doesn't have that many moments.
Yeah.
And it was funny because even in that conversation, Miller kind of, when I asked him about it, he cast his eyes downward and got really quiet. And he said, you know, I've thought about it a long time and I've decided that if he ever offered it, I'd be willing to accept Jake Tapper's apology.
Yeah.
which is just a classic Stephen Miller moment.
Yeah. Talk about his role that he plays in the White House and maybe tell it through the story. This was fascinating, I have to say. You talk about how the president likes to stage these cable-style news shout fests in the Oval Office, and Miller takes a role in these. What is that about?
Yeah, well, so a lot of the people I've talked to who have known President Trump or worked with him will say that the way that he processes information is by hearing people argue about it, right? So he's not a big, you know, briefing books guy. He doesn't like to settle into his study and read through pages and pages of briefing books. What if there's a question that he's being faced with or some you know, debate that he needs to weigh in on, he likes to have he basically programs, like a crossfire segment in the Oval Office where he'll have two White House staffers or maybe more and put them in front of him and have them argue about it. And you know, and obviously the people who have worked with him a long time have learned the tricks of how to kind of persuade Trump to their point of view. What's interesting is that two things are interesting about Stephen Miller in these situations is one that Trump has found that if there's not somebody in the Oval Office who can make a certain case that he wants to hear, he'll often call Miller into the room and just have him make the case, regardless of whether he believes it or not. Which I think is, you know, says a lot about Miller's contrarianism and how good he is at that kind of thing. The other thing I've heard from Miller's colleagues in the White House is that he's very good at this, not just at the contrarianism, but at persuading Trump. He knows exactly how to kind of bring Trump along to a certain point of view. One administration or former administration official said, it's not that Stephen knows everything in the world. It's that he understands Trump. He's been dealing with him a long time and he understands how he inputs information. And I think that kind of speaks to how Stephen has become so influential in this White House.
Well, he's managed to survive, and that's not easy in that White House. You mentioned how he keeps his head down, and you also say for those close to him, it seems like there's that on-camera persona that he seemed to be showing off for you in some ways. You know, the living up to that persona that he carefully cultivated all those years ago, and the real person, and the real person seems kind of likable, at least for those in the White House, right?
Yeah, well, inside the White House, he is, you know, among his colleagues, this is one way he distinguishes himself from a lot of the other people who have flamed out, like Steve Bannon or Sean Spicer or whoever else. He doesn't kind of collect blood feuds or, you know, try to, you know, have rivalries with other staffers. He doesn't spend a lot of time trying to, like, knife other, you know, aides in the press. And actually, people kind of get along with him. One person told me that he's kind of self-aware about what his public persona is, and will often kind of nod to it in kind of mischievous ways. But in person, his colleagues generally like him, and I think that that's one of the reasons that he's been able to last so long is he's not the source of a lot of these damaging leaks. You know, all these palace intrigue stories that you see in the New York Times and the Washington Post, Miller often isn't named in them at all. And I think it's partly because he's not usually one of the sources for those stories, and also because he meticulously avoids having beefs with whoever is in power at that given moment in the Oval Office.
You know, you were mentioning before that really big underlying question in the story that you wrote, and that is, you know, what happens when a troll grows up to run the world, you know? And they're really good at rhetoric. They're successful at electoral politics. They're really good at managing a base. But how are they when it comes to actual governing? Hmm. And maybe we should talk about the rollout for the travel ban, which seems like a pretty good objective illustration of something that was handled terribly.
Right. Well, so this is the interesting thing, though. So, you know, you'll recall the travel ban, the first executive order that banned travel to the U.S. from these majority Muslim countries, was in the first week of Trump's presidency.
Yeah.
And it was written kind of hastily. It didn't have any guidance on how it should be implemented. And Trump signed it on a Friday afternoon. And immediately, airports across the country kind of spiraled into chaos. You know, there were all these travelers were detained and civil rights lawyers descended. And, remember, there were cameras everywhere and there were protesters everywhere. And I remember thinking this, and I think a lot of people did, watching it, that like, oh, wow, this is just proof of how dysfunctional and bad this White House is at, you know, doing anything, that they're just so incompetent and disorganized and whatever else. And I think there is some of that. But, you know, there's been reporting that Steve Bannon, who worked with Stephen Miller on the travel ban, they kind of worked together as the two main guys in the West Wing kind of pushing this.
Yeah.
Steve Bannon was quoted saying that that they enacted the travel ban on a weekend, quote, so the snowflakes would show up at the airports and riot.
Yeah.
Which, to them, they saw the anger on display and the strong reaction from the left as a political win. You know, that for at least some of the people in the West Wing, I don't think it was everyone, but at least some of them, the way this was enacted, the chaos that it caused, was part of the plan.
Let's talk about how Stephen Miller might be changing, if he is at all, because you do say that he's sanded off some of the rougher edges of his persona. But is he still the same kind of guy, still interested in this provocation?
I mean, I think he is. I think a good example of this was, frankly, the family separation policy at the border, which that policy actually wasn't implemented when I was writing this story. But so I wasn't able to talk to Stephen about it, the specifics of it. But it is clear from the reporting that followed that Stephen Miller was a key kind of champion and architect of that policy. And again, you know, to him, the backlash and outrage over that policy was a feature instead of a bug, right? I think that you could see during when that was all playing out and a lot of the Trump administration officials who were forced to kind of go before the press and answer questions, you could see that a lot of them were at the very least uncomfortable, if not ashamed, then at least chagrined, right, that this thing had kind of spiraled out of control. And that is a natural human response, right? But to Stephen Miller, I have to say, I don't see any evidence that he would have been put off by the outrage and the protests and the kind of the endless news cycles about it. I think that was probably part of the outrage. I talked to, another constructive controversy, for example, the way that he put it. When I was talking to Miller, he told me that that basically any time Americans are focused on immigration policy, he thinks that Trump is winning. that, you know, Trump campaigned on this issue and then he was elected president. And it doesn't matter what the polls say. It doesn't matter what the media says, that Americans are with Trump on immigration. And, you know, every time that immigration is dominating the news, that's a good day for Donald Trump.
His editor at the college newspaper said something interesting. Let me go to that finally, because it's hard to tell, he said, if Miller was really was this cruel or this unempathetic, or if at some point he was just going to reveal that this is a big, you know, a joke or a big bit of performance art. I mean, that is the mystery of Stephen Miller in some way.
Yeah, you know, she said that when she was in college with him and editing his columns or whatever else, that that she often kind of vacillated between two perspectives on Stephen Miller. One was that that he was, you know, engaged in some kind of big act of performance art, and that someday we'd all learn that this was a big joke, right? That this was like a character that he had honed. And then the other position was that maybe he really is deeply unempathetic, perhaps even cruel, say were Darby's words. And, you know, the final conclusion that she's reached is that maybe both were true. And I do think, again, that at the end of the day, you know, when somebody like this has this much power and is enacting policies based on his, you know, worldview and trolling ethos and all of that, the ultimate question of what motivates him might not matter as much as, you know, the results, the consequences of what he's doing.
McKay Coppins, his article in The Atlantic is called Trump's Right-Hand Troll. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tess Goodwin. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.